Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, my radio listeners. It is so wonderful to be joining you this afternoon. As you, those of you who may have been following me, we're looking at social injustice or social justice here in the United States, and we've gone on a number of topics relating to social justice or the structure of justice in the United States. Today, I was compelled to look at what's going on with the refugees trying to find a safe haven from their war-torn places, and how supportive is the United States in helping to relocate and find these safe places for persons fleeing persecution of all kinds. And there has been a lot of media coverage of a number of persons leaving their homeland and coming in through Germany and Turkey. And the biggest splash was the killings that went on in France. And if you're listening or following the presidential debates, you know that Donald Trump has advocated all types of things, such as building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico to stop the, as he called it, illegal alien movement into the United States from Mexico. He has advocated the issuing of green cards and other type of marking agents on anyone who is of Muslim faith. And there's been crosstalk on, is this really what America is all about? If you've been following my discussion on social justice, we have been pointing out that some of the injustices that we see against Black Americans that's now starting to be in the news, the concept of police force extreme violence and the revealing of judges giving inordinate sentences and wardens benefiting from the incarceration of Black men. I had shared the show a couple times with a friend, talked about these sentiments of superiority, sentiments of not wanting the foreigner, in this case they call them refugees, in America, it's not new. I rather suggest that you consider that there has always been this undertone, this covert existence of very hate-filled, very prejudicial thinking, but it had never been highlighted. I was reading a lot of entries on what is going on with the police officers being found guilty of first-degree murder in shooting unarmed Black men, sometimes 17 times, sometimes walking away with their hands up. And the comment was made when this young white male driving down from Columbia, South Carolina, got to Charleston, went into a church among Black Americans, sat and listened to their service, and then opened fire and ended up killing 9 people. All through the newspaper the following day had comments saying, oh, the church people forgive him, that they are not feeling malicious and da-da-da-da. However, when this couple opened fire in California and killed a number of people and wounded a number of people, there was no discussion of forgiving. Rather, there was a major investigative kind of discussion on these persons. Did they have any kind of Muslim connections? Did they have any ISIS connections? And it went on this gun control program needs to be implemented. And the whole spirit was retaliatory. We don't want Muslims here. We want to prevent this from happening. Suddenly, there were those talking bluntly about rapid-fire guns and how Americans don't need that to meet the Second Amendment protection. And I had to pause and say, okay, 9 people in a church die, and the news media speaks only of forgiveness, the whole sense of reconciliation, no foul, nothing harmful. And then they begin to talk about the shooter in terms of his depravity. He came from a home with a single mother and so forth. And it is too stark. It is too evident now that the news media presents the same crime differently depending on who is the perpetrator. Now, I've been saying this for years, and a friend of mine, I thought fondly of him, died 2 years ago, and we used to talk about, if you read the newspaper, all black people are thugs, and all black people are aggressive. And if you get the same crime committed by someone who is not of color, you will get a whole psychological dossier. You'll know what his mother did. You'll know what his father did. They will even tell you what he ate. He may have a Twinkie defense. And no one really said, why do we have this mixed kind of presentation? Why do we have this slant? Well, when you get a presidential candidate like Donald Trump, who starts saying what American people have been covertly doing, not speaking it out loud, but giving a black man a 60-year sentence and a white man probation, having a black man sit in jail because he doesn't have the money to pay himself out of bail and someone else goes on with their life. These kinds of things aren't talked about. There's no law. They don't rush to Senate to protect against this and protect against that. But in my studying about nutrition and how the way in which Americans are given food, the industrialized food, and all the laws of protection have been put in place. In 1984, they had the hamburger law. You can't sue anybody if you think the food of a hamburger is creating a problem. That was made into a law. Then there was the protection of the dairy, that when Monsanto was injecting, and still is, injecting cows with this synthetic growth hormone so that he could mature heifers faster to breed and could get more milk production, they rushed into a law in 1994. You cannot sue the dairy industry if you suspect that these hormones are in any way adversely affecting you or your children. So it begs to ask, where is justice in America? I mean, we have the Statue of Liberty standing there and bring us your tired, your weary, and so forth. But what I have told friends, few in America tend to look at the history. The United States was formed by the Nordic and European people. And the irony, and I discussed this with a friend recently, is they were running from persecution, at least from their point of view. They wanted to have the right to practice religion without state interference. And when they came to North America, they identified themselves as pilgrims. And pilgrims came into a land already occupied. The settlement in Virginia wasn't without human beings present. The settlements all along the East Coast had Native Americans. Canada, they had Native Americans, Alaskans, the Inuits. But the pilgrims pushed the Native people aside, established their own forts, built their fences, and when they could, copied the customs that they saw in place, copied what was successful by the Aborigine people, but continuously persecuted, infected, and moved them off their land. Well, after we had the pilgrims, we had settlers. And I always smile when you look at some of the Westerns that Americans are so fond of seeing, and you see them pushing west. What did pushing west mean? It means a group of people crossed an ocean on a boat and got a stagecoach and began progressively invading land that was occupied. No one was welcoming these settlers. No one was giving up their land willingly. The whole concept of scalping the Indian and shooting the Indian and bringing in the cavalry and building forts across this nation as they moved into a occupied territory. So I find it extremely hypocritical to see the Europeans to be so upset, to be so victimized in their plea of making it stop when they say, look at these refugees pushing their way into our country. Look at them invading my personal space. They are sleeping on my driveway and my garage. They're tearing down my walls. They're pushing their way in. And for me, I look at it and say, it would seem that history had this happen before, only it was the European and the Nordic that was pushing aside the Native Americans and the Native Canadians and the Native Alaskans. And this was seen as progress. When I did my research just to see what all the refugee stuff was about, I wasn't surprised, disappointed, but not surprised, that there has been several laws passed. For those of you who don't know, it wasn't until 1964 that people of Africa, Jamaica, and other nations, predominantly of very dark-skinned people, were allowed to immigrate to the United States. That's right. There was an immigration law against the influx of people of color. This was created in 1922. Some refer to it as the Jim Crow law, but it stayed in place, was greatly enforced. And for any of you who are history buffs, in the days right after John F. Kennedy, when there was a boatload of Haitians trying to get to America, the Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard went out and turned them around. They were not allowed to land on American soil. So in 1964, the 1922 law was lifted. Say we welcome the people of color, but they no longer enforced the 1922 immigration law. So effectively, when I hear the term African-American, I have to be careful because since 1964, there has been an influx of Nigerians and other African nationalists who have at least two generations born on U.S. soil, and they are the true African-Americans because they can, like an Italian-American or a Spanish-American, return to a property. They can go home. They can go to a village. They have a language other than English. They have a heritage that is somewhere else, unlike the descendant of a slave that for 600 years there is a people who have been bred as livestock, who have intermingled with Europeans and Native people, and we are the Black Americans, slave descendants, and that to me is a very different group than the current African-Americans who are two and three generations now inside the American geography and tapestry. But looking at refugees, getting back on point, what I found that every year the president and Congress meet to talk about refugee quotas. So part of what I told you, it's not by accident. The people who are allowed to come into the United States as a refugee is decided. It is not based on the hardship of that person. It's not based on their need to relocate. It is clearly a political process. And anywhere there is a political process, someone is making some decisions. Not this one, not this one, not this one, yes, that one. And as we have been pointing out on a weekly basis now, persons in that position to make those decisions aren't necessarily trying to do a fair job or be equitable in their selection because there's no rules, there's no boundaries. It is all how I feel. If I like you, you get in. I don't like you, you don't. The people who are most vulnerable, who have no real profile, who have no special connections to the Senate or Congress or the President of the United States, these are the invisible. And I can't help but remember some language that was used during Hurricane Katrina in 2005. that there was a very eloquent writer, and I'm sad I don't remember the author's name, but they talked about the richness of the environment in New Orleans, how when you went there as a tourist or if you came, it had a milieu that you felt comforted. You had a structure. There was entertainment. There was a richness. There was an aroma. And he said the people who created that milieu were the black people who cooked and flavored things, and the performers on the street, and the shoe shiners, and the doormen, and the maids. And they did it in such a way it was seamless. You didn't know what made you feel good about it. You didn't know why you were smiling. You didn't know why you were tapping your foot. So they were very much part of the system. And you could say even they were invisible, just an invisible force that made the tourism what it was. He said, unfortunately, when Katrina hit, those who were invisible in the normal day-to-day functions of New Orleans, they became the forgotten. And I heard that, and I said, wow, that every time they showed a picture that had to do with the carnival, you saw what was called the Black Indians and their feathers and their garbs. And when you talked about French Quarter, you saw some young black male doing a tap dance or someone playing a saxophone, or you'd see the shoeshine man with a shoeshine stand set up. You'd see the doorman in his regalia at a big hotel, and they bragged about mama this and mama that seasoning and all kinds of foods. And then when the very people they so endorsed and regaled as part of the New Orleans heritage, they were abandoned. Well, that to me is exactly what goes on in the everyday process of refugees. That if you're someone who knows someone or your country can speak on your behalf, then you come into America. And I think it's with eyes wide open that the persons who are handpicking who are considered a refugee are looking very much at the color of the skin of the persons that they are admitting to the United States. In 1975, when Saigon fell, this would be just post-Vietnam War, there was no comprehensive refugee policy. Now, that's what the literature said, but actually the 1922 immigration law was in place, and that was very clear. It did not want people of color coming into America. Well, right after 1975, the South China Sea started having a great number of refugees coming, and from what I understand, America had collaborated heavily with a number of persons during the Vietnam War, and they owed some kind of compensation for their assistance. So in 1980, there was what was called a Refugee Act, and literally what they did is reverse 1922's Act, and gave a little bit more universal definition, what is a refugee, and they began looking for resettlement programs. And the comment was, and it still exists today, and I smile, resettlement programs, some people call it reprobation, some people call it warehousing, but either way, is taking a group of people from a nation that is riddled or torn and trying to give them a place to settle in. Well, the resettlement program for the post-Vietnam War was totally canceled, closed down in 1994. So after that, there was no preferential treatment. There was no focused treatment to take in persons coming from that part of the country. In 2007, the United Nations kind of got involved in another situation where they were saying we need to do more as a world overseer, and we need the United States to commit to supporting more people, a larger long-term population of Middle East persons who were at the time under siege. Well, although they termed the problems and the level of immigration or trying to escape, the level of escape, to that they witnessed in 1948, the reaction from American was very sluggish. The U.S. only admitted 1,000 refugees when they were talking millions that were trying to find haven. And there's some discussion on why is America so slow to respond to this crisis when it was so fast to respond to crises that involved other groups. Well, there's 2.6 million Afghan refugees. 2.6 million. But in the last 20 years, the U.S. has taken less than 20,000. And by 1994, there were 2.3 million, Rwandans. Those are African countries. When you say somebody is in Rwanda, that is an African country. Some refer to it as Sub-Sahara. Some refer to it as Black Africa. But the 2.3 million people of African descent have gotten absolutely no attention from the Congress or the U.S. They have maybe 1,500 people, says less than 1,500. I don't know how much less. I couldn't find that number. From 1999 to 2001, when there was known to be 640,000, so more than half a million, almost three-quarter of a million of people who were in refugee status. So America has been very selective. It ignores those of dark skin. Its movement is sluggish at best, maybe 1%. And there has been some pressure put on other countries. This is like Turkey, as you know, had a financial crisis about 3 years ago, and now we have this big refugee influx. Cambodia had a similar kind of stressor when there was a large South China refugee burden, and the U.S. seems to encourage these countries to absorb the refugees. I know there's a lot of information on the news about Germany, and some of the Germans, because they had had such a history with the Holocaust and Hitler and the annihilation of Catholics and Polish and Jews, that they want to reverse the image of them being xenophobic or afraid of foreigners. And it's very controversial as to how well things are going with their new approach in taking in a very large number, not just taking them in, but somehow trying to get them integrated into their society. Well, what is relevant for now? I talked about several years ago, 20 years ago. Well, out of the more than 2 million Syrian refugees, United States has taken a total of 90, less than 100, since the country's civil war began. I think that number speaks for itself. And if you make a comparison, and it's such a stark comparison, that Soviet Jews have steadily streamed into the United States for decades, surpassing their relocation to Israel, and that came to light about 2 years ago, where more Russian Jews are immigrating to the United States than they were to the established country of Israel. And there was an amendment. There always seemed to be a law instituted to protect something. And in 1989, they had something called the Lautenberg Amendment. And what that really said is if you were Soviet Jewish, you did not have to be suffering persecution to be recognized as a refugee wanting to relocate in the United States. Wow. So you say, well, what's all that got to do with me? What's all that got to do with anything? Well, I call out to you as an American person, if you're not aware of something, you can't change it. And if you say nothing, what was the quote? All injustice has to do the triumph if a few good people do nothing, say nothing. And I listened to the different comments of Donald Trump, and I listened to the mixed reviews. What comes out is the way in which he has just a soft landing after he does something, to me, says he's speaking what many are thinking and few will say. And he has a safety in saying it because no one will go after him in an aggressive way, and no one will call him out. And you'll have a few frontliners that run interference. I don't play football, but I know that you can have a situation where if you give someone a diversion on the field, if you can run some game where I think that one has the ball when this one really does, then you get away with it. And that's what I really see happening. I am extremely exhausted trying to follow the noise, not even rhetoric of consequence, the noise that has become the standard in our campaign process. I grew extremely tired of the email thing. Why would the U.S. Senate waste time going through however number of emails of the Secretary of State? And what was the ultimate reason? It seemed to be a waste of time, a waste of energy. It was, to me, a high-profile way to try to get the people in a negative state of mind for one of the candidates. I think it was strictly political. I saw nothing that said that America was better for having heard all the nonsense that went on. And I don't know that it influenced anything. It wasted time. It wasted money. Then I listened to what they call the Republican debate, and I am just absolutely shocked at how naive a person can be and still be able to run for the highest office of a country. I saw a Saturday Night Live skit, and I don't watch it that much. I don't know the new actors that have taken it over. But in this particular skit, I had to just sit up and listen. When the young man says, in an industrialized country such as the United States, we must come up with some criteria greater than just being born in America and over the age of 35. And when he said it, I had to smile because I had worked with some students in government and so forth, and we talked about different criteria for different offices. And I felt the gravity of that comment. I have nothing against Dr. Ben Carson. In fact, I studied him earlier in my own career. I admired the whole concept. I've read the different books of how, you know, his mother had strong convictions and how he and his brother would go to the library after school and how television was not allowed and how his brother, I think, is in the military and had accomplished great things, and that Dr. Carson had an aptitude for science, and he seemed to have always been a very religious person from all I could tell in the text. He met and married a college sweetheart, and it all sounds wonderful. I have nothing but applause for his expertise. Everything I've read, there's been no neurosurgeon to ever equal what he could do in the correction of epilepsy or seizures, intractable seizures, other type of neurological brain situations. Kudos, Dr. Carson. None of that prepared him to be the president of the United States. His grasp of foreign policy frightens me. His lack of political savvy is just ridiculous. So you can't confuse one expertise for another. When you look at Donald Trump, he made a comment of he wasn't always rich, that when he was young, his father gave him a small loan of $1 million. There's people who work their entire life and never gain $1 million. He is so removed from the general populace. How can he lead a nation of which he doesn't even know? How can he? How can we even consider him? Regardless of his very women-bashing and xenophobic comments. I've looked at the other candidates, and I don't know what to say. I will have to wholeheartedly agree that there should be some criteria in these United States that says you are more than just American-born and over the age of 35. And I think it is extremely shameful and painful for the world to finally see the reveal of the kind of covert hatred and aristocratic beliefs that are alive and well in these United States. With that, I thank you so much for listening, and I invite you to take care. And until next time, be safe.